Doomsday prophet Chad Daybell faces the death penalty for triple homicide. A rancher is on trial for killing a migrant crossing his property. And a father accused of executing his three young sons now says he was insane at the time. All this and much more this week on Courtroom Confidential. Jury selection continues in the death penalty trial for so-called doomsday prophet Chad Daybell. The 55-year-old Idaho man is at long last standing trial for the murders of his wife's children, J.J. Vallow and Tylee Ryan, along with the murder of his former wife, Tammy Daybell. Daybell's current wife, Lori Vallow, and the mother of the murdered children stood trial last year for all the same charges. Vallow was convicted on all counts and sentenced to life without parole. 50 total people must be chosen for the pool of jurors before both the state and defense are able to begin their process of peremptory challenges. All right, well, what's going on here? First of all, you have to realize this is what's called a death qualified jury. This process is going to take much longer than a normal jury selection process, and we're already seeing that happen. It's a very delicate matter. It involves abuse towards children and the death of children. It involves domestic violence to some extent, so there you're going to have a lot of these very sensitive issues that a lot of jurors may want to talk about their experiences with all of that in private. And add to all of that, this is a death penalty case. So each of these jurors has to be what's considered death qualified before they're even able to sit as a potential juror for the rest of the voir dire questioning, meaning each of these jurors have to be able to say that if the circumstances were right, if they felt that the aggravating factors in this case were true, that they could vote for death, that they don't have a moral or ethical or religious reason that would prevent them from ever voting for death as a penalty in any case. Those people who do say that they have some reason that prevents them from ever finding a death penalty are excused. They're not even able to be as part of the potential juror pool. And this process, I've witnessed this happen a couple of times in court when I was in the DA's office and taking part in assisting with death penalty trials. It is incredibly intense. I will tell you, you can hear a pin drop when people are being asked these types of questions about whether or not they could vote for death. Think about it. And this is how the question is asked of them. I've seen this. They will look at one particular juror and say, imagine now that we're past this trial. You and your fellow jurors have already voted for guilt. You already know that the allegations, the aggravating factors have been found true. And now it's time to decide whether or not the penalty will be death, meaning will the state put this man to death, or will the penalty be life without parole? And all of your fellow jurors have voted. Number one says death. Number two says death. Number three, and they go all around the table, and all 11 of them have said death. And now it comes down to you and your juror number 12. And you know that your vote is the vote that could send this person to the death chamber. That your vote is that deciding vote. It has to be unanimous. If you say no, then it's not a unanimous death verdict. But if you say yes, then that person is sent to the death chamber. It, to this day, as I'm saying it, I can feel the hair standing up on my arms. It is such an intense moment because these are questions that we have never really thought about and asked ourselves in life. Could we vote for something like this?
Are you predisposed based on your position to say, listen, I am predisposed, or I believe that if there is a murder, that it needs to be the death penalty, but I would be open to considering other options. But my initial instinct is if there is a murder here, it has to be the death penalty, unless you convince me otherwise, or that I see something that gives me pause not to impose the death penalty. Would that be fair, sir?
Yes.
And it's just incredibly intense to watch someone go through that emotional and mental gymnastics in their head to make that decision. And Just so that everybody understands, the aggravating factors we're talking about at play here are things like multiple murder. You're talking about a triple homicide, not all occurring on the same day that they're even going to try to prove, but that this person is responsible for more than one murder. And in Idaho, they have a factor called, quote, especially heinous, atrocious, and cruel, manifesting exceptional depravity. These are the types of crimes that are reserved for asking the ultimate punishment in this country, capital punishment, the death penalty. If that crime is so heinous, atrocious, cruel, and depraved, and if the jurors find that it is, and they find that this man is guilty, are they the type of person who could say, I believe that the ultimate penalty we have in this country is appropriate in this case? So, trial is expected to last for 10 weeks. I expect a far more robust defense in this case. In Lori Vallow's case, we did not see much of that at all. It surprised many who were watching it closely, as I know many of you were. Her defense team seemed like they were playing with one arm tied behind their back. And we found out later that, in fact, they were. That Lori Vallow was calling many of the shots in that case, including the built-in defense of blaming Chad Daybell for everything that occurred. The same Chad Daybell who's on trial now. And do we think we'll see the same kind of loyalty out of Chad Daybell? I don't think so. I think that his defense team is not more savvy, but I think they are planning on putting on a much more robust, like I said, defense. And I think Chad Daybell, this is just me calling it from the hip, shooting from the hip as far as what I think is going to happen here. I think Chad Daybell is fighting for his life, and he knows it, literally. And he's going to say, go ahead. And if you got to point the fingers at Lori, go ahead and point the fingers at Lori and say that she's the one responsible for all of this. And one other surprise development, I don't know. Could she testify? Does her love and loyalty and religious admiration of this man as this prophet go so far as that she would be willing to waive her Fifth Amendment rights and take the stand in his defense? We shall see. I would be shocked. Absolutely. But I also have enough of a suspicion that I kind of see it on the horizon. This case is going to start, we imagine, with evidence next week. And my hope is to bring you all some live streaming reactions to some of the more important highlights of that case to give you my thoughts as we both watch it together. So please join me. All right, moving on. A 75-year-old Arizona rancher is standing trial for fatally shooting a Mexican citizen who was found dead on his nearly 100-acre ranch just outside the U.S.-Mexico border. Prosecutors allege that George Allen Kelly ambushed 48-year-old Gabriel Cuen Butimea, a migrant from Nogales, Mexico, in January of 2023. He is charged with second-degree murder and two counts of aggravated assault. The county attorney's office has also accused Kelly of prejudicial malice. Kelly's defense argues he was only protecting himself, his wife, and his home by firing warning shots into the air above the migrants. This week's Kelly's wife, Wanda, took the stand saying that moments before Kelly grabbed his AK-47 to fire warning shots, he told his wife that he had heard gunshots and the pair saw men walking on their property carrying guns. All right, well, what's going on here? Kelly's defense is dependent on really two things that his attorneys must establish to the jury, I think, if he's got any chance of beating these charges. That is reasonableness and credibility. Was it reasonable to respond to this perceived threat with warning shots? Even taking warning shots is taking a pretty severe action. Firing a weapon at all is taking a pretty severe action. And even according to his own admission, these weren't rifle shots directly into the air. These were apparently supposed to be over the heads of the individuals who were walking on his property. Was that reasonable? Now, you could say they were in fear. They had heard gunshots in the past. They heard gunshots at this time. They had seen men on their property. They had seen men who were armed. All of that puts you in, I would say, a reasonable apprehension of your safety. Okay. But does that warrant warning shots at 100 yards and warning shots that aren't exactly directly into the air? The other question, though, is credibility. Is Kelly's story more credible than the testimony given by a fellow traveler of the deceased migrant man? Already someone has testified for the prosecution saying that these were not warning shots. They were not posing a threat. They were walking away, and this man just simply dropped dead after they heard gunshots. Now, that person, the defense, I think, has tried to impeach as not being entirely honest in the past. They're already trying to impeach that person for trespassing, for being illegally in the country, all of those things. But it's really going to come down to the jurors, you know, as they do in many cases, making a judgment call as to credibility. Who do they believe more? Whose story sounds more reasonable under the circumstances? I will say that one big problem for the defense is the distance involved here. We're talking about 100 yards, folks. A football field. At a football field, he felt he was threatened enough to fire his weapon. And again, firing it at or over their heads, not directly up into the air, but at or over their heads at 100 yards, is that really the type of reasonable action that one should take? But looking at both sides of this, one big problem that the prosecution is facing here is that that fatal bullet has never been recovered. Is that enough to establish reasonable doubt? That the prosecution cannot say forensically for a fact that the bullet that killed this man came from the defendant's gun. That to me is a big problem, and the defense is already trying to exploit it, and I think that they will further on their closing arguments saying, listen, ladies and gentlemen, there's evidence of other men being out there and other armed men. If you cannot forensically tie this to my client, that's reasonable doubt alone. So we will continue to watch this case. I know that a lot of people have. I know it's causing a lot of controversy for a lot of reasons other than the facts of the case itself. But we will continue to keep you updated. Please let me know in the comments what your thoughts are. Finally, we turn to Chad Dorman, the Ohio father accused of killing his three sons in June of 2023, has now entered two pleas. Not guilty and not guilty by reason of insanity. In response, the prosecution has filed a request for a second mental evaluation to determine Dorman's mental condition at the time of the murders. Dorman's change of plea comes after the judge ruled that the Claremont County Sheriff's Office violated Dorman's rights twice when it failed to advise him of his Miranda rights before interrogating him, and when detectives continued to question him after he said he wanted an attorney. This angers me. It bothers me. I hate to see any time in a case of such magnitude and importance that law enforcement doesn't do everything by the book, because this is what happens. Having been a prosecutor, it is so frustrating to have this type of stuff that you have to deal with, where they could have just done it the right way and we wouldn't have to deal with any of this, but instead, they wanted to cut some corners and play fast and loose with the rules, and now you're losing this entire valuable piece of evidence. But we did cover this whole discussion at length in a previous episode of Courtroom Confidential. We'll make sure that you have a link to that episode. As of this recording, Dorman's trial is scheduled to begin in July of this year. All right, well, what's going on here? If you have been paying close attention to this, entry of a plea of insanity should not be shocking to anyone. Why is that? That tossed confession was the last hurdle that Dorman's defense team had to launching this kind of defense. Because arguing insanity would be very difficult if you have evidence of the defendant confessing to everything that he had done soon after he had done it, especially if that was recorded, if they have video of that. That's going to show two jurors that this man absolutely knew what he was doing and knew what he was doing was wrong. But could this all backfire? If I am the prosecution in this case, I am looking for any opportunity, no matter how small, to find a way to open the door to getting this confession in. The second a defense expert says anything along the lines of, there was nothing to indicate that Dorman was aware of the consequences of his actions, I'm furiously taking notes. And my first question is, oh, really? Nothing? Your Honor, I'd like to take a videotape. Your Honor, wasn't it in fact true that he said, I did this? I don't know the exact words of this confession, but you can be sure that any time they even sniff the idea of opening the door to me getting this confession in, I'm going to take full advantage of it. And it's important to understand, I think, what insanity means here, because I think it causes a lot of confusion. And I plan on doing a whole episode just on the idea of insanity and the role that it plays in the criminal justice system. But this isn't just somebody did something crazy and therefore we think that that person was insane. The definition really says that a person cannot be held responsible for criminal conduct if at the time they lack the capacity to appreciate the wrongfulness of their actions. So it's not, I thought the children were evil, but did you know that taking their lives was something you could get in trouble for? And if you knew you could get in trouble for it, didn't you know it was wrong? Didn't you know it was criminally wrong? Didn't you know, even if you believed it was somehow part of some greater big purpose, didn't you know that they were in fact breaking the law by doing what you did? And that's why you hid, and that's why you said the things that you did, and that's why you made the confession that you did. That's what really the theory here of insanity that is being alleged by the defense, and can they prove that? Now, they're going to try to prove it through experts, but that's why I think now this confession becomes so much more important, because that confession is words out of the mouth of the defendant close in time to when this all occurred. Because again, insanity can be temporary. So it has to do with his mental state at that time. And if he made statements that show he understood what he did, and he understood that what he did was wrong, even if he felt like he was doing it for some other purpose, that just completely blows up that insanity defense. And that's why these Miranda violations were so impactful. If you guys have thoughts on this as strong as I do, please share it in the comments. I'd like to hear what you have to say about it. All right. Also making headlines this week, an Orange County doctor charged with poisoning her husband with Drano now faces new allegations of trying to coach her children to lie about their father. Yu Emily Yu was charged in 2022 with poisoning her husband's tea. After feeling sick for a month and noticing an odd taste in his tea, Jack Chen set up a secret camera in their kitchen. Just think about what he had to go through before he decided to do that. At least three times, the camera caught Yu allegedly spiking his drink with Drano. Yu has pleaded not guilty to three felony counts of poisoning and one felony count of domestic battery with corporal injury. Her next court date is in May. We will keep you updated. Also, disbarred South Carolina attorney Alex Murdoch was sentenced to an additional 40 years in federal prison on Monday for stealing from his clients and his law firm. The 55-year-old is already serving a life sentence without parole in state prison for killing his wife and son in a case that we all followed. Last year, Murdoch was ordered to spend 27 years in state prison for financial crime charges. The federal sentence will run at the same time as the state prison sentence. Before we get into the cases next week, please hit that subscribe button. Like this episode if you enjoyed it. Please share your comments. We always appreciate hearing your thoughts and tips for what you would like us to cover next. But on the docket for next week, Jesse Krasinski, who was found guilty last year of fatally poisoning her friend with Visine eye drops, is set to be sentenced today. The Wisconsin woman was convicted of first-degree intentional homicide and two counts of theft. The homicide charges require a mandatory life sentence, plus she faces an additional 10 years of imprisonment for each count of theft. And finally, both parents of Oxford school shooter Ethan Crumbly are set to be sentenced next Tuesday, April 9th. Jennifer and James Crumbly were both found guilty of involuntary manslaughter in separate trials that were watched very closely by legal observers and others alike across the country. They face up to 15 years in prison for the four counts. Once again, I'm your host, Joshua Ritter. You can find me on all social media at Joshua Ritter ESQ or at joshuaritter.com. Thank you for joining me. Have a great weekend, and I'll see you next week on Courtroom Confidential.